This is Dr. Roger Green in his teaching on American Christianity. This is session number 10 on the Second Great Awakening.
So a word about the setup for the room. This is so small here to try to do this and put my notes and everything, so it's been kind of driving me bonkers. So I did email the provost at the beginning of the semester, and I said, is there any possibility of having a lectern in this room? Even a music stand from the music building, that would have been fine. Anything to put my notes in so I'm not wrestling like I've been doing for the last 5 or 6 weeks. So yesterday they presented me with this lectern. It has my name on it, the Roger Green Lectern right here. And it has the seal of Gordon College right here. So this is gonna remain, and this is gonna be my gift to Gordon College. The provost said I can take this with me when I retire. I said, no, this is gonna be my gift to Gordon College for this room. It's right here, this nice lectern. They even gave me a space underneath to put stuff here. So now, finally, I'm set to teach in this course. And so we are ready. So yikes, what could be better than this? So here we are. We are ready now. So thanks to Gordon College for that. Okay, so where are we? This is the Second Great Awakening, Lecture 7, the Second Great Awakening. I'm on page 13 of the syllabus, so that's where I am. And we're talking about the awakening, and I'm going to give a bit of an introduction, and then we're going to talk about these people. But I want to say a couple things before we talk about Timothy Dwight. So he's there. So, okay, now... We've mentioned before that at the time of the Revolutionary War, there was a bit of an ebb in religion in America. It seems like people's interests were more political than religious. So what we have seen so far in the course then, we saw a very strong religious impulse with the Puritans. But then remember the Puritans, there was a dying down of that religious impulse among the Puritans for a while. But then we come into the middle of the 18th century, then we have this first great awakening. Remember that we talked about in the 18th century. And so that brought a real strengthening of Christianity in America. Then there's that pendulum swinging back again to more, less religion, more politics. Well, the Second Great Awakening, in a sense, is an answer to that. So the Second Great Awakening is a resurgence of Christianity in America beginning, we usually put about 1800 as the date for the Second Great Awakening, so that we see that. The other thing we want to kind of take notice about the Second Great Awakening is that in the last, say from 1750 to 1800, so from that period of time, during that period of time, the territory tripled, and the population grew five times. So in those 50 years, the amount of land that was being settled tripled. That's a lot. But also the population increased five times in those 50 years. So there is tremendous expansion going on. And the question that the Second Great Awakening kind of raised is the church going to be able to keep up with this expansion, or are we going to lose the battle to this expansion? Which is it going to be? And they decided that they wanted the church to keep up with this expansion. They wanted the church to be a mission to all people, and a mission to the growing numbers in this new land. So they made that decision, and thus began, as we'll see, the Second Great Awakening. Now, what we're going to do here is we're going to talk first of all about the leadership in the Second Great Awakening. So that's the awakening, and there's four names. Page 13, there's three, and then the fourth comes after that. And then we'll see what happens with all of that awakening, and then we'll do results. But okay, the four names I'm going to mention. The first one and the most important is Timothy Dwight. Timothy Dwight. Those are the dates of Timothy Dwight. Very important. He became the president at Yale University. Now, we've already said when you think of these universities, don't think of the universities that you picture today with thousands of students and many buildings and so forth. Yale was still a small, pretty tight-knit community. Yale, however, had lost its religious bearings. And Timothy Dwight became the president of Yale, and he was determined that he was going to bring back religion into the life of Yale and into the life of Yale students. And so as the president, he not only taught classes at Yale, but he also preached the gospel from the chapel at Yale. And so the first, we usually put the date 1800 for the first Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening. The Second Great Awakening really began at Yale with Timothy Dwight and with his preaching of the gospel. So that's where it started. And there was great revival at Yale. There was a real awakening at Yale, the kind that had been true of the first Great Awakening with people like Jonathan Edwards. So Timothy Dwight, an important name who kind of, in a sense, begins all of this. But then there were three other people that we want to mention. The second and third are associated with Dwight. The second one is Lyman Beecher. So here is Lyman Beecher, and he's also in your syllabus, but Lyman Beecher is really very, very important person because Lyman Beecher had been trained at Yale by Timothy Dwight. So Lyman Beecher was a student of Timothy Dwight at Yale. And Lyman Beecher picked up the revival impulse, in a sense, from his teacher, from his mentor. You'd be familiar with the Beecher name. You're probably familiar with his daughter, Harriet Beecher Stowe. So the Beecher name became important in American life. And Lyman Beecher, now he is known as a preacher. He's a great preacher. He's not the college president or teacher or something, but he's kind of the pastor who helped to bring about the Second Great Awakening. So we do need to take note of Lyman Beecher. Third name is Nathaniel Taylor. Nathaniel Taylor was at Yale at the same time Timothy Dwight was the president of Yale and a teacher at Yale. But Nathaniel W. Taylor was a professor at Yale University at this time. And he helped to instigate the Second Great Awakening. He himself, like Lyman Beecher, he himself had been trained by Timothy Dwight. He had been a student of Dwight's at Yale. And so he picks up this impulse of the Second Great Awakening, and that really becomes important. Now, the fourth name is not associated with Yale or associated with Timothy Dwight, but it is a name that needs to be mentioned, and it's a man by the name of Alexander Campbell. Now, we're going to see in a few minutes that the Second Great Awakening had two places where it happened. It happened in the north, but it also happened in the south. Alexander Campbell was a churchman in the south, and he helped to bring about the Second Great Awakening in the southern states. Alexander Campbell, a little bit later, as you can see his dates, but Alexander Campbell began a movement called the Disciples of Christ in the south. His movement, he was the founder of the Disciples of Christ. And this movement was a really awakening movement in the South. Now, we have a name for the Disciples of Christ and for the movement of Alexander Campbell. And it's a title, it's a kind of a theological title that we wouldn't use for the first three people that we've talked about. And the title that we give to them is Restorationism. So we need to figure out what is Restorationism. And Alexander Campbell is a perfect example of this, as are the Disciples of Christ. Restorationism is a belief that your denomination, your group, is restoring the New Testament church. So you see kind of a purity in the New Testament church, you're bringing that into the 19th century. So there are groups that we would call restorationist groups that feel that they are the true representative of the New Testament church and are kind of keeping alive the New Testament church in a way maybe that other churches aren't or that other groups aren't. And so Restorationism becomes an important part of the Second Great Awakening, but in the South. And this picture to the right, that's a picture of Alexander Campbell. So if I were going to choose four leaders of the Second Great Awakening, these are the four that I would choose. So, okay. Now, when we talk about the Second Great Awakening, we also want to mention Charles Grandison Finney. I'll add his name to this. Charles Grandison Finney. Those are the dates for Charles Grandison Finney. And let me just go to the next slide. Here's a kind of a picture of Charles Grandison Finney. The reason we mentioned Finney is because he also began a great revival, the Finneyite revival. Now, his dates are later, as you can see. So the question is that we won't worry about now. We'll just raise it now, but we'll ask when we get to Finney himself. Was Finney continuing the Second Great Awakening, or was there enough of a break in American religious life so that we call Finney's revival, the Finneyite revival, a Third Great Awakening? How should we label the Finneyite revival? Is it a continuation of what was begun by Dwight and Beecher and others? Or was there a break and now the Finneyite revival starts a really a third wave or a Third Great Awakening? We don't need to kind of settle that here. We've got a whole lecture on Charles Grandison Finney, and you read an article about Charles Grandison Finney, so we'll worry about that at a later time. But here we just raise the matter. Also, in terms of people, we've already talked about Wesley, Coke, and Asbury, and so I just want to mention them also in terms of people who would, in a sense, were involved in the Second Great Awakening, because remember, Francis Asbury was finally ordained in 1784, and becomes the great itinerant preacher of Methodism in America. So we do want to just mention them. Okay, so now we want to talk about the manifestations of the Second Great Awakening. The Second Great Awakening had two very distinct manifestations. There were two kind of parts to the Second Great Awakening, and they were really quite different from each other. But they both come under the kind of the umbrella of the Second Great Awakening. Okay, so the northern manifestation of the Second Great Awakening, Timothy Dwight is kind of the perfect example of that. And there's his dates, but the Great Awakening at Yale. Now, the Great Awakening at Yale, and which was followed obviously by other places, this is Timothy Dwight on the left-hand side here. The Great Awakening at Yale was very... took on very much of the New England culture. It was restrained. There was not a lot of emotionalism. There was great preaching and great singing of the hymns of the church and so forth, and people came to Christ, but in a very kind of restrained, unemotional kind of New England kind of way, kind of a Gordon College kind of way for this Second Great Awakening under Timothy Dwight. But the fact of the matter is that the Second Great Awakening had another manifestation and a completely kind of different manifestation. It had a southern manifestation, and the southern manifestation was entirely different from the northern manifestation. This is a picture here of the southern manifestation of the Second Great Awakening. The manifestation of the Second Great Awakening was of the camp meetings. Now, the first camp meeting to be held was Cane Ridge, Kentucky, and it was held in 1801. Cane Ridge, Kentucky, 1801. Now, this is a new phenomenon. This is something that hadn't been experienced in American church history, American religious history before. The camp meeting is people coming together for maybe 10 days, maybe a couple of weeks. And you can see here in the picture in the background, there are tents, see where they live in the tents. And on the left-hand side, you can see someone preaching there, and the people are listening and so forth. So the camp meetings became the southern expression of the Second Great Awakening. But the camp meetings were very different. The expression in the South was very different from the expression at Yale, because the camp meetings in the South were very emotional. They were using lay preachers. These were often uneducated people. They knew the Bible, knew the stories of the Bible, but they were lay preachers. They didn't have any formal training. They didn't train with Timothy Dwight at Yale and so forth, so they didn't have the theological knowledge. But there's lay preachers. There's a great emotionalism in these camp meetings. There's a lot of people singing and dancing and fainting and so forth. So it was a totally different experience from what people in the North were experiencing in the Second Great Awakening. So the camp meeting experience, very interesting. Now, whenever I talk about the camp meeting experience, a couple of things. Camp meetings still go on, you know, a couple hundred years later, there are still camp meetings in various places, and not just the South. But so have any of you been to a camp meeting? That something you would say would be a camp meeting, 10 days, 2 weeks, the emphasis is on Bible teaching, preaching, singing. So something like that sounds a little familiar to you. Okay, a couple folks. Anybody else been to a camp meeting? That sounds familiar to you. So not many of you have been to a camp meeting. I participate in camp meetings a lot during the summers. Two big ones are in Old Orchard Beach, Maine, camp meeting up there, and then another one is with the Methodists in the South at Lake Junaluska, North Carolina, is a huge camp meeting that comes together there. What is the closest camp meeting to where we are right here at Gordon College? What's the which was a big camp meeting. In fact, they had to build a little bit of an extra railway line to come out because so many people were coming from Boston out to the camp meeting. Is anybody familiar with Asbury Grove? You do? You lived there for the summer. Bless your heart. Asbury Grove. Okay. Asbury Grove. Now, you know the history of Asbury Grove, do you? Some of it? Do you want to tell us any of it? Or you want to help with this lecture or not? Asbury Grove was a great camp meeting here in the North. They had the extra railway line come out because it was so large in those days. They don't get the numbers now that they used to get. Pardon? That's great. Oh, that's great. Okay. And you lived, did you live on the campgrounds?
Yeah, I lived okay. In
okay, and the name of the chapel, do you remember the name of the chapel? It's the E. Stanley Jones Chapel, who was a great Methodist missionary to India for many years and so on. So. Right, okay, so Asbury Grove. You can, if you drive down, is that Railroad Avenue? What avenue is that goes by Christ Church right to Asbury Grove? I forget what street that is. But do some of you know where Christ Church is? If you know where Christ Church is here in Hamilton.
It's kind of where the train station is, where the Crosby is and the Duncan and all that. If you go right past it, like a mile.
Right. So there it is. Right in our own backyard, there was a great camp meeting experience. And who was it named after, of course? Francis Asbury. So the great, you know, Methodist revivalist evangelist. So camp meetings weren't limited to the South, but they were large and still are large in the South. And I don't think Asbury quite has the numbers it used to have, but the camp meetings in the South or even up in Old Orchard Beach, Maine, are still quite large camp meetings. So there it is. That's the second expression of the Second Great Awakening, and it was pretty remarkable expression. Now, the people in the North did tend to look down on the experience in the South because they saw that as too emotional, letting these lay people preach who didn't know theology and so forth. So there tended to be a little bit of a looking down on what was happening in the Southern camp meeting experience. But you have two very distinct experiences in the North and in the South. Okay, now what we're interested in is number B on page 14, and we're interested in the results of the awakening. And I'm going to give six. I mean, you could give a lot more. The sixth one is going to take us a lot more time. So that's why I've saved that one till the end. So the results of the awakening. Okay, first result of the awakening is an increase in revivalism in American culture. American culture got quite used to revivalism being part of the culture, part of the kind of the Protestant world. And so now we've had a first great awakening, now we have a second great awakening, an increase in revivalism, and as we've mentioned, that increase in revivalism is going to be seen in Charles Grandison Finney later on. And then later, at the very end of the 19th century, it's going to be seen in a man by the name of Dwight L. Moody, that we don't need to worry about now, but will come to him. And then at the middle of the 20th century, it's going to be seen in a man by the name of Billy Graham. So revivalism as part of American life and culture, as part of kind of a Protestant expression of religion, that's going to be part of our life here. So, okay, a second kind of result here is the expanding network of what are called voluntary societies. Voluntary societies. You had a little bit of this on the exam, but what voluntary societies, in this case, voluntary societies mean kind of organizing at a local level for certain projects. So people, Christians who were believers, but also people who became believers during the revival, they would organize at the local level for certain projects. And that local level of projects would be often cross-denominational. So Presbyterians and people from the Congregational Church and maybe some Methodists, maybe some Baptists would come together and they would associate for a particular project that they wanted to do. Now, it was out of this that came the great kind of missionary movement of the 19th century, the American missionary movement. Because the greatest of these local projects were the formation of missionary societies. And these missionary societies became pretty strong. There was the 1810 was the first formation. It was called the American Board of Commissioners of Foreign Missions. But basically, it was Congregational and Presbyterians coming together to form an 1810 form of missionary society. So that becomes really important. And it becomes important for the history of this very institution. Because a lot of years later, in 1895, this place was founded as a missionary society, a missionary training ground by A.J. Gordon to send missionaries to the Congo. So formation of voluntary societies, but especially missionary societies, very important. Okay, number three is a stress on education. Stress on education. Now, under education, what I'm going to mention here are three things. Number one, stress on education, but number one, a tremendous distribution of Bibles, getting Bibles into the hands of the people. And along with the Bibles, there would be things called tracts. Now, tracts would often be four-page paper gospel tracts that tell the gospel story. So along with the Bibles would be tracts getting into the hands of the people, but you want the people to be biblically literate once they become believers, once they've been converted. So that'd be the first thing. The second thing this stress on education is something that started in England earlier on, but not a whole lot earlier on, and that was Sunday schools. Sunday schools are going to be kind of an educational enterprise now in the churches, in order to teach children to read, so that they could do what? Of course, read the Bible and understand the Bible. There was a reason for that. Now, the number three, and the most important here, is the founding of other colleges, universities, and seminaries. So it is time now, they feel, to train our pastors and so forth. So the founding of college universities, founding of seminaries. So here's kind of another wave of founding of those things. And let me just go to some. I'm going to mention some of the seminaries, some of the most important that were founded. Andover Seminary was founded in 1808 by the Congregationalists. Now, my wife and I love the town of Andover. I don't know if you're familiar with Andover. One thing I've never done, however, which I have to do, is find out where this was exactly founded in Andover. I'm not sure of that, so I'd really like to find that out. But the Congregationalists found their own seminary. We've mentioned Princeton University, but the seminary was founded in 1812. University, of course, founded earlier as the Log College. Seminary was founded in 1812. And the seminary was founded to train Presbyterian preachers. I had an interesting, long story short, but I had an interesting experience. I went to Princeton for an MTH degree. I'm not Presbyterian, but I had a very interesting class in Princeton mostly with Presbyterians. And the class was on the 1967 Confession, because the the lead writer for the 1967 confession, which in a sense took the place of the Westminster Confession, the lead writer was a professor by the name of Dr. Dowie, and he had a class on the 1967 confession. So I thought it'd be kind of interesting to sit in on that class and to hear the discussions among Presbyterians about the 1967 confession. This was just a year later. My first year at Princeton was 1968. I could be very objective about this. They couldn't. And so the discussions in that class about that 67 confession were very, very interesting. And some of the students saw the 67 confession as the greatest thing that's ever come down from the mountain. And others saw the 67 confession as the worst thing that the Presbyterian Church ever did in life. And so there was some interesting, it was a fun class for me to be an objective observer about this in. But nevertheless, Princeton Seminary, I have fond memories of Princeton for a couple of years. The 1967 confession, which was a replacement of the Westminster Confession for Presbyterians. And so the whole class, we went through the confession pretty much line by line. It was a pretty, pretty long confession with notes about the confession and everything. So very interesting. Yeah. Thirdly, we've mentioned Harvard, but their divinity school was founded in 1816. But remember, it's founded by the Unitarians. The confession, kind of a confession of faith that marks what believers in that particular denomination believe, what they adhere to. So we've always had confessions in the church. The Apostles' Creed was finally developed as a confession. The Nicene Creed, the Chalcedonian Creed. So, right, it's a statement of basic beliefs and that you hold to, but it's not just that. It's not just kind of a doctrinal kind of affirmation of something. By confessing the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed or Chalcedonian Creed or the Westminster Creed, by confessing, you're giving your life to that creed. You're saying that this creed is so important. This creed is everything. This creed is, you know, I'm ready to live my life in conformity to this creed. So it's not just an assent. Oh yeah, I happen to believe that. It's a life commitment to that. That's why discussing the 67 confession in class for a semester was a very existential experience for those Presbyterian students, because, you know, am I going to give my life to this creed or not? So does that help?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
Like, there must be some kind of like loyalty to your creed. I mean, you're talking about this convention being mixed up because of that, having to switch gears from the Presbyterian to the Westminster. I don't know what the big differences are.
Right. Well, that would take us. Yeah, that would take us a whole semester to do that. And we're not all Presbyterians here, but so it wouldn't be existential for everybody. But they are doctrinal confessions, but there again, not just assent. You're giving your life to this confession. You're staking your life on what this says. I have the Bonhoeffer seminar, and a couple folks are in Bonhoeffer. And in Bonhoeffer, we're going to talk about the Barman Declaration. The Barman Declaration was something they gave their life to. They put their life on the line for the Barman Declaration. So that's what confessions and declarations are. Yeah.
So when you are talking about like them founding seminaries at Princeton or Harvard, weren't those originally places where they were training ministers?
Yes. These had grown. Now, not Andover. There was no university or anything. But Princeton, Harvard had grown into universities, kind of after the German model of kind of research universities. So they were no longer, they were a place where you could take courses in theology and courses in divinity and so forth, religion, but they were no longer places that actually trained ministers. So that's why the 19th century, beginning of the 19th century, these seminaries were founded, often attached to universities, but they were founded as seminaries specifically to train people for ministry. Not true of Andover. Andover was a standalone, but true of Princeton and Harvard. And then I'll mention just one more here, and that's, of course, Yale. The Divinity School at Yale was finally founded in 1822. So Timothy Dwight was leading the Second Great Awakening at the university, because the seminary had not yet been founded. But in 1822 it was founded, and it was founded to train congregational preachers. So this interest in education, but especially what we might call higher education and seminary education, becomes really, really important. Okay, other questions about the interest in education? Okay, let me go. We've got to go back to a slide here. Okay, stress in education. Okay, the next one, you've got these in your outline too. But number four is moral and humanitarian crusades. Lots of moral crusades, humanitarian crusades. That is going to be very important as a result of the Second Great Awakening. Because the Second Great Awakening stressed this loving God, loving your neighbor. Okay, let me mention three movements that would become really, really important in the broader American culture, but yet were movements really begun out of concern of the Second Great Awakening. Okay, the first one, you'd be familiar with all three of them. First one is going to be a temperance movement, a movement of total abstinence from alcohol, temperance, because in the large cities, of course, there had been a proliferation of people coming into these cities to work, and a terrible kind of plight of alcohol abuse and so forth. Well, the Second Great Awakening started to attack that and develop a temperance movement in the Second Great Awakening, which becomes kind of a national movement. The second one would be a peace movement, which is very interesting. We're going to see this when we get to Charles Grandison Finney and Oberlin College, but the peace movement, where we're hoping, praying, that the 19th century is going to bring about peace and shalom and God's peace and to the world and so forth. And so the peace movement and Oberlin College, Charles Finney Oberlin College, going to stress that. The third one, of course, is going to take precedence over everything. The third one is going to be the major, major, major movement and battle of the 19th century in America, and that is going to be the anti-slavery movement, the movement for abolition of the slaves. This begins now with the Second Great Awakening, but as we go into the 19th century, of course, in American public life, this is going to be a major event, and the churches are going to enter into this, and there's going to be great struggles over this. But the abolitionist movement is going to overshadow everything else. Any other kind of temperance movement or peace movement, the abolitionist movement is going to distinguish the 19th century in American cultural life and religious life. So we'll see a lot of that. Okay, that's one through, number five. I didn't get number five, and that is a growth in many denominations as a result of the Second Great Awakening. Lots of denominations grow. Let me give you just one example, and that would be the Methodists. Here's a couple of 1784. Let's take that date, 1784. At the time of when Asbury's being ordained and so forth, there were probably about 15,000 Methodists in the colonies. 1784, 15,000 Methodists. Now remember that Methodism is not yet a breakaway movement. It's a movement trying to re-energize the Anglican Church, and it's a movement stressing revivalism and so forth, but it's not a denomination. So 15,000. Okay, second kind of example, and this is 1850. So 1784, there are 15,000. 1850. By 1850, there are over 1 million Methodists in the colonies and further out west and down south and so forth. There are over 1 million Methodists. So that's a growth within 65 years or so of 1 million people. Now, part of the reason for the growth is because now Methodism, after the death of John Wesley, is a separate denomination. Methodism has broken away from the Anglican Church. It's a separate denomination. Actually, there are a number of Methodist denominations, especially in England, there were a few of them. But Methodism in America is seen as its own thing now. And it had a real appeal, especially because of the people like Francis Asbury, especially because of the itinerant ministers. So Methodism is just one example I could use the Baptists, I could use Presbyterians, I could use Congregationalists, but denominations are growing after the Second Great Awakening, trying to keep pace with the Western expansion and the Southern expansion. We can, for us, what happened was that while Wesley was still alive, he felt very unfortunate that Asbury and Coke began to call themselves bishops. In other words, it sounded like they were forming a separate denomination over here, and he was opposed to that. He actually called them to come back to England. They wouldn't go. So he was actually opposed to that. But technically, no denomination is formed until after Wesley dies in 1791. Then when he dies in 1791, then you could kind of say that American Methodists now see themselves as a denomination. And over in England, there were probably by 1795 or so, there were probably three or four Methodist denominations in England who broke away from the Anglican Church. So it's a little fuzzy. It's not exact kind of science, but with the death of Wesley in 1791, that's when Methodism starts to form itself in terms of a denomination here and in England. Yeah. It's time off. Thank you. We've got one more question. Wesleyan Church began in this country as a church opposing slavery. So that's middle of the century, and we're actually going to talk about the Wesleyan Church because that's how it began, as an anti-slavery movement church. Right? They named their church after John Wesley. So yeah, but that becomes a denomination. But that's not what we're talking about yet here because they're not formed until the middle of the century. So. Okay, bless your hearts. We're going to stop the lecture here.
This is Dr. Roger Green in his teaching on American Christianity. This is session number 10 on the Second Great Awakening.